Dr. Snee.
Hi, Charles. How are you doing?
Good. How are you? So we're in Building 10 again.
We are in the cool room.
Definitely. So what do we have today?
So I'm here with Michael Wallant, who's the general manager of the Windows Client Division. And Michael's kind of the guy responsible, really, in most ways for Avalon, Windows Presentation Foundation, and a bunch of associated technologies. So, so Michael, I mean, just tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your background? How long have you been at Microsoft?
Sure. So I've been at Microsoft since August of 1996, so I'm coming up on 10 years. Started working on Internet Explorer, and the first thing I actually worked on was dynamic HTML. In 1996 and 1997, I was the dynamic HTML dude.
Wow.
I wrote a bunch of columns for...
The HTML dude, I remember that.
That was me. Yeah, I was lead program manager responsible for dynamic HTML in the IE4 timeframe.
Right.
And worked with, you know, Christian Fortini and Rod Chavez and a bunch of other just awesome developers working on that at that point in time. I went on the road and was talking to everybody about trying to use dynamic HTML, and worked with a lot of the people who work in evangelism today, both Charles and Vic.
Right.
We're both in it at that time and in really different roles. I got to write a lot of interesting samples, wrote a ton of data binding samples, like a virtualized data list box with dynamic HTML, which is pretty cool.
Right.
I wrote asteroids for dynamic HTML.
Yeah.
Which one of my good friends from Boston described as a, well, you can put lipstick on a pig. Yeah. But I thought it was pretty cool anyways.
Yeah.
We did that. We did dynamic HTML and IE4, and I did IE5. I was the group program manager for our Trident team, which does HTML rendering in IE5, and then ran the IE team for IE5, 5, and IE6.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what we were trying to do that whole time was, although we didn't really call it that, we were trying to build web smart clients.
Right.
I remember some of the first presentations we did on dynamic HTML, and it's kind of interesting to look back on it, where it's like, hey, we said dynamic HTML was four things. It was what we called dynamic styles, which was the ability to do something like change a color on something, or change the font size of something, or do something like that. Or one of the key things we did that kind of was a last minute add that I was strongly advocating for in IE4 was the display property, being the ability to either make something invisible, which was visibility hidden, or display none,
right,
which would essentially take it out of the layout and make it collapse up.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
And those are really the enabling features of a ton of the dynamic HTML that you see today on the web, mm-hmm. which is, you know, menus and toolbars, because if you can make stuff go away and reflow,
right.
Well, that's pretty much it. So that's right. Dynamic styles. Then we talked about dynamic content, which was the ability to inject content into the system. That was inner HTML was the first thing we did, and then later on we did the ability to add elements kind of on the fly without the parser using create element.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about data binding, which has always been a technology before its time in many ways. For many applications, people say, oh, that's really cool, but then they don't actually use it in the app itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last thing was dynamic positioning, CSS positioning, which we partnered really closely with Netscape on some of the early specs. And that was, if you remember, like layers versus everything else, mm-hmm. and kind of the battle there and trying to work out with them kind of what the standard was going to be. And that was probably the best example ever of Netscape and Microsoft cooperation was getting to a common CSS positioning spec.
Right.
So, you know, it was those four things. And if you remember back to like IE3 or NAV4, when you resized your browser, the page reloaded,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is why there were features in the browser like when you hit the back button, the forms refilled. Well, that wasn't to make it so when you went back, the forms refilled. That was so if you resized the window, you didn't lose all the content that you had inside of it.
Yeah.
Right? It was crazy.
Yeah.
We were trying to build this client platform. And, we went off on escapades. Like, we wrote add remove programs with Trident in Windows 2000. Outlook Web Access was written on top of IE5,
right,
using behaviors and using the first XML HTTP object, which one of my friends, Alex Hopman, was the program manager on, and in many ways, I think, is responsible for creating XML HTTP object for Outlook Web Access, which has become kind of the heart of Ajax today.
Right, right, sure.
So we did all that. We did behaviors, and we did behaviors because we wanted to have a component model in the browser. And there wasn't really one, and there wasn't really a good way to encapsulate your code or to build reusable objects in a robust way. So we tried doing behaviors, which was interesting, but didn't really solve the problem in a robust way.
Mm-hmm.
In that you really couldn't subclass, it was only aggregation. And then we had this fundamental problem that, you know, even though we invented things like VML to generate office documents from IE5, that's why we did it to begin with.
Right.
Even though we did that, the problem was that basically a little line segment had the same weight as a button in memory. So while if you were going to use something graphically rich, you might have, you know, 10, 20,000 line segments on it, well, the system would kind of come to a screeching halt because it wasn't meant to scale to that many elements on screen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we finished up with IE6 in 2001, and we said, well, you know, we have this real choice because, hey, this web thing has really taken off, and we've got to make sure we build a platform for that.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not really sure that Trident is going to do it for us because of the scalability issues.
Right.
And because, you know, the programming model between script and between C++ is radically different and is fraught with security issues.
Mm-hmm.
And the system doesn't really scale to meet the problems that we need to meet. I mean, it doesn't really do a great job with media. It does an okay job with UI stuff, but we felt in many ways really limited with the amount of content we could do there. So we said, hey, you know, we're going to start this new project, which was codenamed Avalon, and we started it towards the end of 2000, the beginning of 2001, to try to build a web client platform that was a follow-on to Trident, but something that was modern and we could really build Windows on top of, not
right.
just, you know, dancing hamster websites.
Right. So when you started Avalon, I mean, was that really your goal to replace, to supplant the web as we know it today, or was that kind of just the contextual background? I mean, you describe it as kind of hitting those kind of limitations and barriers, most of which, I guess, to an extent, we still face even today. Was that kind of the direction you saw things at the time?
Well, you know, replace is such a nasty word. You know, I think what we were looking at that time is, you know, people wanted to build richer applications, and there wasn't really a good way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
HTML is great for a lot of stuff. I mean, no one loves HTML and dynamic HTML more than me. I mean, I poured my heart and soul into it for 6 years, right? It was awesome. But the fact is there's some types of applications that you see people today where they fall off the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my favorite example is, you know, like, every photo website has their own way to do file upload for photos.
Right, right.
Right, they end up writing kind of custom code. They write binary code that has to get installed on the system to help you better manage your photos.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not a seamless experience.
Right.
So, you know, what can we do to create a better seamless experience for the times that people actually want to do that? You know, and let's face it, right, the other reality today is that Macromedia and now Adobe have really cornered the market on, you know, rich websites
mm-hmm.
using Flash.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Flash is used on a number of super rich websites to build experiences that you can't build in HTML.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the market recognizes that HTML is good for some stuff, and then to go to kind of to the next step, you need other runtimes, because these HTML runtimes, you know, kind of coming from their SGML background, only can do so much.
Right.
And you can't push it too far, you're not going to get a great user experience out of it.
So, I mean, you described there, I mean, the way that obviously HTML doesn't sort of solve all the problems. So to just go back to the genesis of Avalon as a project then, how did it sort of incubate from that sort of stage of, you know, these are limitations that we face? How did you get from, you know, one man with a bright idea to a team of 100?
Well, I don't want to claim that it was just my idea. You know, we had, basically what happened was that we had a set of really smart folks working on Internet Explorer and a set of other smart folks working on the internals of Windows itself.
Mm-hmm.
And we merged those two teams together to create the Avalon team.
Right.
So we thought of it as the best of the Windows, the best of the web. And, you know, we had a couple of really important decisions to make right up front. And I'd probably talk about three. as really critical decisions. One was, what code base did we want to start from, mm-hmm. and how did we want to start? The second was, what markup language, and how was markup related to this? And the third was, manage code or not manage code. So let's go to the manage code one first, because in many ways that was a seminal decision for us. If you go in the Wayback Machine back to the end of 2000, early 2001, .NET 1.0 hadn't shipped yet. It was still 6 to 8 months away from shipping. But, you know, the writing was on the wall that that this was the place that the company was putting its developer bet on going forward. Mm-hmm. And from my point of view, looking back in time to Trident, you know, Dynamic HTML, once we shipped it in 1997, was a little bit of the red-haired stepchild inside of Microsoft from a developer perspective. It wasn't like FrontPage at that point in time really did a great job authoring dynamic HTML content. Microsoft didn't have great developer tools that targeted dynamic HTML as a platform,
right.
other than for web content. I mean, Visual Interdev was a not as good as it could have been.
Well, it was really very server-orientated, right?
Yeah.
So it was all around building ASP sites rather than anything about the clients and how
right.
those sites looked.
Right, and I remember having, you know, super interesting discussions with folks literally across the street with around, you know, client-side development and is web development really about the client or is it really about the server? And, you know, I would assert that we were not strategically aligned on dynamic HTML as a platform
mm-hmm.
And really valuing it as a client technology. So, you know, my bias when at the end of 2000, early 2001 was, oh my God, I'm not going to build another developer platform unless we're lined up strategically as a company behind it.
Right.
Because there's no way that we're going to be successful only building a UI platform. We've got to build out platform, tools, evangelism, server support, and kind of an ecosystem around mm-hmm. it, or we're just going to fail. It's going to be a big whatever, and it'd be a waste of time for us and for our customers.
Right.
So we said, hey, you know, managed code is where the bet is. It wasn't ready for prime time then, and it was really server-focused then. But if we look at the challenges we had in Trident with extensibility and with code security, it solved those problems for us.
Mm.
And you know, we felt like this was a no-brainer that we had to get on that path.
Mm-hmm.
So we made this huge bet that was very controversial at that point in time to build this whole thing on top of managed code.
Right.
Kind of the next big challenge for us was, you know, what about the markup language? And, you know, boy, that was contentious, and it even is still contentious. And kind of the choices were, boy, do we invent our own markup language, or do we build something based on XHTML?
Right, right.
And I have to say that at that point, my bias was, hey, we should build it on top of XHTML, because we had just gone through this embrace and extend model with Trident, with dynamic HTML.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I think, successful in many ways, but geez, what do we do? And kind of the thing that changed my mind on that was, we said, well, if we do XHTML, and we've decided we've done .NET, then the markup language and the programming model are going to be radically different.
Right.
You know, if you look at programming model for the CSS style object with dynamic HTML, you know, element.style. You know, then some camel capped name here that's different than the name that's actually in the property, and there's all these mini languages to it, and some things you can set programmatically and some things you can't set programmatically,
mm-hmm.
some things you need the parser for, some things you don't need the parser for. It's not really a good, robust, toolable programming model.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then are we going to have a class called A? You know,
right.
Probably not.
Might not hit the FX Cop guidelines at least.
Yeah, it wouldn't necessarily be consistent with what developers expect.
Right.
We said, boy, you know, if we're going to have this dichotomy between classes and markup, and we don't want markup to be a second-class citizen, you know, because we want to have a model, and we have a model today where we have parsed markup,
mm-hmm.
and we have compiled markup. And compiled markup is the same as if you would have written the code to generate the elements yourself.
Right.
Like, we wanted this parallelism between the markup and the code.
Right.
And we felt like going down the XHTML path would have gotten us to a world where the programming model and the markup were never going to be peers,
mm-hmm.
and where markup would be a second-class citizen from a performance point of view, because it would always require a parser in many ways to kind of get to the code on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And the other real challenge was is, you know, like let's take HTML tables, for example. I've gone through that process where you try to build something that's compatible with HTML tables. And that code is gnarly because the spec is super gnarly.
Right.
And the level of complexity and sophistication required to get it right and be compatible with all that mm-hmm. stuff is super hard. So in many ways, I felt like if we felt that Trident didn't have the performance characteristics that we wanted, and some of the asynchronous issues that exist even today that people have, where what order do events fire in, when is my script there, when is it not there, when can I call a method, when can I? To some extent, I felt like if we attempted to implement the same spec with a different set of engineers, were these engineers that much smarter than the last set of engineers did it? Would they do something that was that much better?
Right.
So we said, well, if we do XHTML, we're going to get to something that has just as many extensibility issues as the thing we already have, and that seems kind of crazy.
And you're kind of describing the fact that you kind of wanted to free yourself from the baggage of the past, at any rate, that you were kind of hitting the boundaries. So clearly, sort of just building more on top of that was perhaps not a kind of a long-term solution there.
Right. And the other thing that we had is we had this vision that you know, Avalon is designed not to have a singular framework on the top, where today mm-hmm. we have a framework with a certain control set on top.
Mm-hmm.
We think of that as everything above the UI element layer. Mm-hmm. The system is designed to have alternate frameworks on top of the UI element layer. So we said, look, the first one we're going to build is kind of a the to the metal one, where the markup is not XHTML mm-hmm. and where the program model is the same, but be free to build an XHTML model or a module on top of it in the future.
Right.
So we decided to go with XAML at that point in time. And that went through a bunch of different iterations. And there were sub-discussions in there about, hey, do you do CSS? Do you do an XML-based model for doing mm-hmm. styles? And that was a long discussion in and of itself. And then the third area, the third issue with Avalon was, hey, what code base do we start with?
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff Bogdan, who's one of the mm-hmm. key engineers here, he had this model. He said, well, you do pimp or you do prune. You know, do you take a code base and do you prune it to get to the code base you want? Or do you essentially take the bits that you want to build the system that you want and you can leave away more legacy?
Right.
And what we decided to do is we went with effectively the pimp model for both GDI, GDI Plus user, and for Trident,
mm-hmm.
and started to build the core of Avalon.
Right.
And then we kind of started on our merry way in mid-2001, kind of on that tack.
Right.
Interesting.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about that merry way a little bit, but...
It's been a long, challenging merry way.
It has, I know. So, but just before I do, I'm just interested in... Just again, just from the incubation process, who did you have to kind of persuade to build this team, or you know, what kind of buy-in did you have to get internally to turn this into a reality?
Basically, Bill.
Right.
You know,
so you went and pitched him, or you?
Many times.
Right.
Many times. You know, we effectively what happened was is that we had a charter when we merged the Trident team with the user and D-user teams together,
mm-hmm.
we had this charter to build the Windows client platform. And even though we had the charter, we didn't have a design. So then over the next 6 months, we worked through a bunch of different iterations and plans to kind of get to a design where we could go forward.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting incubation project because since we merged these two existing teams together, we kind of started with 300 people. Which is a lot of people.
Right.
And when you're trying to incubate with 300 people, sometimes you screw it up. And I think we probably wrote a lot of code too quickly initially uh-huh. and had to go back and fix some of it.
Right.
But effectively, you know, I spent a lot of time personally like pitching Bill, pitching Jim Alchin,
mm-hmm.
Pitching people around the company in terms of what we were doing to get them bought into it.
Right.
To make sure that people knew and weren't going to freak out.
Yeah. And what kind of pushback did you get? What kind of... you know, what kind of process did you have to go to kind of refine that with them? Were they kind of, did you have to persuade them about the whole sort of principle, or you know, what kind of steps did that kind of take in terms of influencing the project?
Well, it was more like trying to lay out what the vision. I mean, one of the initial vision points that we got people bought into was, besides the three things I mentioned before on managed code, not basically starting from scratch and having a different markup language,
mm-hmm.
there were lots of questions at that point about who are the customers for this.
Right.
And we said, look, we're going to build an integrated platform for UI documents and media.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that what we did more than anything else is we got the company sold on this notion of an integrated platform,
mm-hmm.
and we got the company sold on a notion of building it without a cliff from managed code from the bottom up.
Right.
And from there, it was an implementation detail. And, you know, while it was an expensive implementation detail, that was the thing that we got people bought into.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, looking at where we are now, we're sort of, 5 years on from those kind of stages. I'm interested to know what you think are the greatest sort of successes of WPF, as it's now called, as in its current state. What are the things that are the biggest surprises for you in the last 5 years through this process?
So I guess that's a successes and failures comment kind of wrapped in a question about surprises. You know, I think that the thing that is probably the best issue all up is the integrated platform between mm-hmm. UI documents and media. I think, you know, we had that notion back 5 years ago, and I think that was probably the most important decision we made,
mm-hmm.
Which is not to say, look, we're going to have graphics in a box, and we're going to have documents in a box, and we're going to have media in a box, but rather have these things all work seamlessly together.
Mm-hmm.
It's really easy to forget how different that is from where other platforms are today.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, even if you look at where XHTML is today, you have the SVG module, where things in an SVG module are in a box. They're in the SVG box. You can't put,
right.
you know, a button inside of an SVG box. You have to use positioning to position something on top of it. There's no encapsulation there.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big deal.
Mm.
So that integrated platform, I think, is huge. And I'll look to the success of that as saying, you know, the XPS Viewer application. Well, what is it?
Right.
Well, the XPS Viewer application is a small piece of code that manages the UI on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the XPS format just gets fed to the parser to get rendered.
Right.
Because XPS is simply a subset of XAML mm-hmm. that is targeted towards fixed format documents.
Mm-hmm.
XPS
standing for XML paper specification, right?
Right, right. Or, you know, we've worked closely with a bunch of CAD vendors to build subsets of XAML markup that are focused on the 3D and graphic space.
Right.
Right, and they can output the content and open it up kind of in a viewer on our platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Super, super interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So that integrated platform, I think, is really key. I think the other thing that's been really cool is to see how XAML has evolved and how people have really embraced it.
Right.
You know, it went from, hey, it's our markup language for the programming model, to something that across the company people have embraced as a way to create, you know, real-time representations of trees of elements, be
mm-hmm.
they presentation elements or even workflow services elements or, mm-hmm. you know, in the future data elements. Maybe there'd be some interesting link integration there in the future.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way that we've been able to use kind of styling and templating there and really let designers and developers work really, really well together and free the notion of the way the application looks from the application behaves,
mm-hmm.
I think that will turn out to be really cool in the end. In terms of things that I wish we did better, I can't wait to when we get the feature in to have XAML plus script. I think that we went too far down the road of installed, compiled applications,
mm-hmm.
and we need to better embrace kind of interpreted code and script running against it, doing a great job with JSON integration, doing a better job with HTML interop. You know, I want to be able to have script from an HTML page, tweak elements in an XAML page, and have that work seamlessly.
Right.
And we just have to get that done, and we're not going to get done for 2006. We will get it done shortly thereafter.
Right, right.
So that, I think, will be huge in terms of the adoption of Avalon on the web.
Yeah.
The other thing that I kind of wish we did a better job at is having a clearer layered system. You know, today we have the media integration layer, the MIL, which is the very lowest layers of the system,
mm-hmm.
which talks with private interfaces to Avalon and to our Windows Vista Desktop Window Manager. I think there's a lot of customers who would like to use that power in their applications,
mm-hmm.
and we need to give them an API for that.
Right.
And we're going to do that. We're
right.
going to build an unmanaged MIL API that can be thought of as the moral equivalent to GDI and GDI Plus
mm-hmm.
to make graphics applications really up to the modern 3D model for graphics cards and really take advantage of that.
Right.
And that's something we're going to have to do in the future.
Yeah.
And then there's a couple other critical layers kind of in Avalon that I think that, that developers want to take advantage of at different times, like the visuals layer, the managed visuals layer, I think developers might want to use in their applications in a more seamless way. And then having the system be a little bit more pay-for-play, where you can come in at the right level, use only what you want to use, be really clear about what that is, mm-hmm. and kind of make your application shine.
Right.
Effectively, it's, I think we've done a great job helping people build brand new applications and bringing them forward, but I really want to focus going forward on helping people migrate their existing applications to use the power of the platform that we've built.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing is, oh my God, it took us 5 years. I think that you know, in hindsight, it would have been far better to try to ship half of it, you know, 2.5 years ago,
right.
get that out there, get feedback on it, then build the second half.
Right.
And, you know, we've learned that lesson from that. And from our planning going forward,
yeah.
we want to be on a yearly or better release cycle with new value to our customers and kind of get stuff out in the market. Because, you know, 5 years is a super, super long time for people to wait
right.
for this stuff.
Right.
We built all this plumbing now, and now we want to build some houses on top of the plumbing and have those get framed up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I guess one of the interesting sort of things we were kind of, Charles and I were kind of talking on the way over about how, you know, from an emotional standpoint, applications today need to be much more visceral in nature than, you know, than they were in the past. Profusion of really high-performing graphics cards that I guess probably you guys hadn't sort of been able to anticipate 5 years of GPU development at the pace that they've sort of done, where even over the last 3 years the acceleration has continued. It's really enabled people to build applications like some of the things we've shown at conferences like Mix and ASCAR, 3D kind of user interface style demos, things like the North Face and their kiosk prototype and things like that. And I'm interested to hear your views as to, you know, what are the kinds of applications that you see WPF as enabling from an emotional standpoint. How does Avalon enable people to build applications that people just enjoy playing with, that are just physically more attractive to work with?
You know, there's definitely one element to it, which is what we thought of back in 2001 is the ESPN effect.
Right.
Where if you looked at SportsCenter, even back in 2001, when they showed a graphic on screen, the background wasn't just a static graphic, but there was something kind of gently animating in the background. Or the way that they show the sports scores on the bottom, it doesn't just snap, it animates,
mm-hmm.
and it looks smooth, it looks professional. So people are used to that really high-end kind of luxury experience. And to some extent, it's a feel issue, where people have got to trust their applications that has to feel professional.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they pay a lot of money for computers, for their computing devices. They want them to feel like something they can trust and have connection to it. So, you know, I think that part of what we need to do is to make it really simple to create things that look and feel professional and polished. You know, ironically, one of the interesting things is one of the first designs we did back in like 2002 for Avalon for Styles was the gel button.
Mm-hmm.
And now I see gel buttons everywhere. I saw an ad on TV the other day that actually used the gel button style. Because it kind of looked cooler, and we can do an interesting shimmy effect in there that you don't
right.
need to do. But nevertheless, it's just about something looking richer and more compelling.
Uh-huh.
In terms of where people actually get a lot of value from that, though, because we didn't do it just for eye candy. Because in the end, if you do it just for eye candy, it's a big whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You might get a few kind of interesting high-end entertainment applications to take advantage of it, but then, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a few really important roles for this. One is around enhanced data visualization. I am super interested in helping to craft the line of business application of tomorrow that goes beyond the master detail grid.
Right.
You know, even our own, we have this internal application called MS Review that, you know, all managers have to use in September as everybody gets a review score and a bonus and a raise and some stock. And, you know, I have a pretty big organization, and I need to wade through this big grid of people. And it's really hard to find people. It's really hard to relate them together. It's really hard to compare them. Because
mm-hmm.
the visualization tool is a big flat list with numbers. Well, if I was to rethink that using the capabilities of WPF, how would that be different? Well, I'd probably build it as a hierarchy, and I'd probably have the people be nodes, and they'd have color values where I could see kind of what their review score was and how it related to their peers, and I could see immediately if somebody had like the wrong spread. So, boy, that's a really cool way to visualize my data. The other thing I'm super interested in is reading.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things my team done is research on basic reading. And Bill Hill, who's kind of a world-renowned speaker on this topic,
yeah.
Who's a fascinating guy to talk to, his team has done research to figure out things like scrolling versus paginated content, or how long line lengths should be, or mm-hmm. how fonts should be crafted to create the right readable experience. And we've taken a lot of that research and kind of poured it into Avalon
mm-hmm.
to get, you know, multi-column text that's automatically paginated. And, you know, his research shows that people are 30% more effective when reading paginated content over scrolling content.
Right.
So I think that people are going to be able to do super interesting paginated content for reading
mm-hmm.
on the web, because that's what a lot of people do. They
right.
read content on the web. So I'm interested in data viz, I'm interested in reading, and then I'm kind of interested to find out kind of what's next and what people can do to use these tools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we did dynamic HTML in 1996, I don't think I would have been able to predict some of the really cool things that people are doing today, like the mashups or the map applications. Those are pretty amazing things.
Right.
I don't think we would have predicted that, but now we've got this amazing set of tools that's available to virtually every developer on the planet. I'm just interested to see what they come up with
mm-hmm.
and kind of where we can help them go in the future. So, you know, it's really unlocking the power of the PC and unlocking the power of these developers to do amazing stuff. And boy, it'd be outrageous for me to predict kind of what they were going to do, but I can't wait.
Right, right. So, I mean, we're close to release now, right? So we're going to ship Avalon Windows Presentation Foundation along with the rest of the WinFX stack this year for Windows XP and Windows Vista. Looking forward sort of 12 months ahead, say, how do you think we can measure the success or failure of Avalon? How will we know whether this has worked out or not?
I think there's a couple things. You know, from our experience with dynamic HTML, I think we had the wrong expectation back then
mm-hmm.
that when we shipped and, you know, we had 0% market share at that point, that we would get, you know, thousands of websites to switch over on day one.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've learned our lesson since then. What I want to have at launch is I want to have 5 to 10 killer experiences written on top of the platform that couldn't be done any other way,
mm-hmm.
that are really, truly differentiated. And that 12 months out, that we have, you know, we're going to ship about 200 million PCs a year. Those will carry Windows Vista, so that'll be about 200 million there. And we expect that, you know, of the 400 or 500 million Windows XP machines that are out there today, we'll get a pretty good share of those. Let's say we get half within a year that actually carry WPF.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so we'll have about 500 million customers that you can target, hopefully within the first year. And we will be successful if developers and business people see the value of betting on the platform, and customers demand a differentiated experience on top of that platform.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no customer demand, if people can't say, oh my God, this is different, I want it, it's better, it helps me with my business, you know, my customers are more excited, they have a better experience, they buy more, they stay more closely, they get their data more easily, then, you know, then all this money will be for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got to be about the customers, and it's got to be about the businesses and helping people make more money on the platform.
Right, right. Now, I mean, internally, we've got, you know, the Avalon side. There's also Atlas and the kind of work going on to, in a sense, reinvigorate that sort of whole browser side. How do you see that kind of playing out? Do you see it as a kind of a friendly rivalry between two teams, or do you see it as something where the two just will become united and will just merge into one whole, you know, almost going back to my first question,
right.
is the web ultimately dead? Is the HTML kind of world really, you know, is that just hitting its sort of ultimate limitations or not?
No, I think that for the foreseeable future, there will be HTML-based web browsers. HTML is a great system. HTML is the most important programming platform in the history of humanity, right? And we're not trying to replace it. What we're trying to say is, you sometimes want to go beyond that, and if you want to go beyond it, here's a great way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, hey, Atlas, I support that effort entirely, because that's about making the HTML programming platform better. And there's lots of stuff we can do there to make that better. And innovating in that space is a great thing, and some customers will absolutely want to target that. Mm-hmm. For people who want to target, you know, multi-platform, multi-vendor, you know, worldwide, no control on the client systems, that's great. But they need to understand that there's some ceiling that they're going to get to, that is the maximum functionality they're going to get to. You know, if they want to do heavy data viz or 3D virtualization, or I kind of think about it as the line between content consumption and content creation. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's really the bright line where, you know, there have been some applications written with dynamic HTML that are about creating content. But what you find, like whether it be Outlook Web Access or there's, you know, Writely, which is a Word, you know, Word competitor, there are some things you do, but it's almost going back to the Asteroids example. It's not really clear that's the best way to do it. And even like in Outlook Web Access, the edit pane is actually an ActiveX control.
Right.
Because they needed to have more control over essentially events than they could get with dynamic HTML and JavaScript.
Sure.
So when you get to content creation, I think that's when you need the power of a platform like WPF. Because you could write PowerPoint with WPF. You could write Excel with WPF. That's mm-hmm. not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, could you write, you could easily write, you know, other heavy-duty content creation applications. I'm not sure you do that with dynamic HTML.
Mm-hmm.
So, look, people need to decide where the right place is to target for them. We're going to invest in both. We're going to invest, you know, in tools, platforms, and services on both. And we've got to make sure they work well together.
Right.
And not, you know, one competing with the other. But, hey, the more work that Scott does to make Atlas great, that's a great thing for our customers, and who can be against that?
Sure. I'm kind of surprised in the way that you didn't mention WPFE in that.
Ask you about that.
Well, you know.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Where does that play in that sort of convergence there?
So I think there's two interesting places for WPFE. One is that for customers who have built full-on WPF experiences and want to take some of that value and move it onto other platforms, WPFE is a great place to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that we think that with WPF and WPFE, we've done a great job with designer-developer split
mm-hmm.
and with having an open platform for building tools on top of that. You know, we want, you know, the thousand flowers to bloom on people building tools for WPF and WPFE.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anybody can write to the format. There's no licensing restriction on that whatsoever. And we want people to go nuts building tools for that. So we think WPFE will be an interesting play for people who want kind of maximum design reach, and specifically kind of one of the things that hasn't been really come up much is WPFE carries a new codec from Windows Media called WMV plus alpha. So we can do alpha video with WMV, and it carries a lightweight codec for it that will go cross-platform.
All right.
So if you want a cross-platform WMV viewer, WPFE is a great solution for you there.
Oh.
So I expect that one of the ways that WPFE will be adopted very quickly is actually any place where you want to view Windows Media video content or Windows Media audio content, we've got a great player for you that works cross-platform.
Cool.
Which is kind of sweet. Kind
yeah.
of an interesting you know, side benefit to that. And you know, WPFE kind of fits into the Rich Islands model that we talked about at the PDC, where, you know, if you want to build great, you know, application content, use Atlas. If you want to build the best user experience for content creation and kind of experiencing rich interactive content, mm-hmm. WPF is the way to go. And if you've got something in the middle where you want to have it be a little bit of the best of both worlds, well, WPFE is a good solution for you there.
Right.
WPFE is also a platform play for us in that WPFE can also understand XPS. So our XPS viewers, our cross-plat XPS viewers are going to be built on top of WPFE, the runtime engine for that as well, so we can really make that platform super open, worldwide, on every platform at any time,
right.
And have it just work.
Yeah.
So, just a quick question: with WPFE, are you saying that I can basically have all of Avalon XAML at my disposal and have it run in the browser on Linux?
Not quite all of it.
Okay. So there's a subset.
And the subset really, there's two critical bits to it. One is there's some parts of WPF that really require hardware acceleration mm-hmm. to be effective. 3D is the best example. You really can't do animated 3D without hardware acceleration.
Right.
On the PC platform, where you know what drivers you have, it's pretty easy. We are not going to be doing, you know, 3D or animated 3D in WPFE right now because we just can't depend on the hardware on all the different platforms we would go to. One of the reasons why WPF doesn't run on Windows 2000 is not because we were lazy, but because we looked at the machines running Windows 2000 today and said, vast majority of them are not going to be hardware accelerated. They've got a small amount of memory. People aren't going to get a good experience there, so we're not going to try to do it. Mm-hmm. But we are going to run WPFE on Windows 2000, obviously.
Right, cool.
So you've got to scale to create the right experience. And the other thing is, boy, we're trying to make it super small. Mm-hmm. Like, the core engine for WPFE, you know, I'm making the team kind of get that to about 800K for the core engine. Mm-hmm. So there's only so much code you can put into that.
Right.
So, for example, one of the areas that we're not doing in WPFE right now is flow text. You say, well, you know, why is that? Well, because we think flow text is more than just bottomless flow. You need to do things like pagination. You need to do things like hyphenation and justification to get that nice bright edge, which actually really aids in readability.
Right.
It turns out that those are really expensive features.
Right.
You know, just like just hyphenation and justification can be like a meg or more
right.
to do that one feature.
You're going to ship dictionaries and things like that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you have a big platform or it's already installed, you can do a lot of stuff there. But if you want it to be small and portable, we can blow it out. And there's some features we're not going to have. So I put 3D in and kind of deep text flow. Now, are we going to have bottomless text flow? Yeah, we'll probably get to that, but not in V1. Uh-huh. But the things, there's some part where you look at the cost benefit and where the costs are just super high and the benefit, it's like, well, not really sure there's a big benefit there.
Right.
So we have to kind of be careful about that.
Yeah.
And we also, you know, look, we're going to ship, you know, my goal for that team is to ship 3 times in the next 18 months.
Wow.
And if you're going to do that, you can't bite off, you know, the whole steak in one sandwich or in one bite. So, you know, we'll get there and we'll incrementally make it better.
Yeah. So just turning back to Windows for a moment, we ship on Windows XP, we ship on Windows Vista. Are there any differences between those two? Can you expect to see WPF running better on Vista? Is there any code compiler changes that make it different? Why should people upgrade to Vista, is, I guess, what I'm saying.
Well, there's no platform difference between XP and Vista. However, I think that the most important issue on Vista for graphical application developers is the new video driver model.
Right.
And there's really two critical things there. One is the use of the 3D parts is virtualized on Vista, whereas on XP and other platforms, there's no virtualization, so the app that has focus basically steals all the frames.
Right.
And the other thing that's virtualized is the video memory. So video memory is virtualized in Vista, whereas on XP it's not. So, you know, Vista is a system designed to have multiple hardware-accelerated, either Avalon or DX applications running at the same time.
Right.
Whereas XP, you could get one Avalon application running pretty well. You add two when they're trying to go for frames and go for hardware, they're going to be in contention. Mm-hmm. And while Avalon is kind of well-mannered and doesn't steal overt resources, if you try to load up a DX app that steals all the video memory, because quite honestly, one of the first things that most DX apps do when they load is they allocate all the video memory so they have it.
Right.
Because they're not used to being in a sharing situation, because it was designed for games.
Yeah.
Right. And so what we've effectively done is we've built a new API on top of DirectX that is Windows, and to do that, it needs to be virtualized.
Right.
So, you know, there's work there we need to do. So I think that'll be the biggest difference between XP and Vista, is kind of the quality of multiple applications and the quality of the graphical subsystem running. And also on Vista, it'll be more stable, it doesn't blue screen, like the drivers don't run in kernel mode as much, they run mostly in user mode, there's hang detection, there's a lot of real critical benefits for graphic developers on Windows Vista,
right.
That we think are pretty important.
I mean, you say don't blue screen. I mean, obviously Avalon, our goal isn't that it blue screens on XP, right?
But But I mean, you know, the biggest producer of blue screens on Windows XP today are graphics drivers. Mm-hmm. It's gotten better, but you know, hey, that's really hard code. Mm-hmm. There's lots of innovation in the hardware. The drivers come out really often. And people are really pushing it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in many ways, the history of these drivers is they were tuned for a given game. Oh, get the new version of Doom. I'm going to have the best driver for that version of Doom. and they weren't designed to be running, you know, five nines reliable on a desktop.
Right.
So the video card manufacturers have done a fantastic job really driving up the quality on Vista with the new Windows Vista device driver model. And we think we're going to get a ton of benefit from that, and hopefully that'll kind of come down a little bit into the XP driver model. But you know, it was kind of used for a different purpose. We've repurposed something that wasn't originally designed or intended to do that, but hopefully in a way that adds value.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Certainly.
So just one last thing as we kind of look forward to Windows beyond Vista. Do you see Avalon being used in the shell and places like that much more? I mean, what can we imagine sort of as futurologists sort of looking forward to
right.
future versions of Windows in terms of exploitation of this stuff?
So, you know, going back to think about one of the lessons that we learned from Vista and from Avalon in general, you know, we were early on in Longhorn building the shell and Avalon kind of at the same time. And that wasn't a great experience for anybody, because people building on a platform want that platform to be pretty stable, they don't want their code to break, they want stuff to work, they want their bugs fixed. And when you're trying to build a platform at the same time you're building something as big and as complex as the Windows shell, it doesn't really work very well. So, you know, we took a step back with Vista during the reset to say, look, we're going to have only one part of the shell written using Avalon, and that's the desktop window manager, which does the flip 3D effect and the thumbnail effect. And
right.
Like, we're super proud of that work. I mean, that was really good, but what did that do? That went very low in the stack to something that was stable. So what I expect going forward with Windows is more of Windows will use the lower part of the stack, the mill, get some benefit from that, and then we'll slowly migrate over time and move up the stack as we get to some more stability there.
Right.
But, you know, asking developers to build on a platform that isn't done isn't a recipe to make the platform team happy or the developers on that team happy. You know, and boy, bless the Sparkle team for building Sparkle on top of the platform while we were building it.
Right.
The platform wouldn't be anywhere near as good as it is without their help.
Yeah.
But you know, like look at a project like Windows Max, which is a real good indication of where we'll be going in the future in terms of visualization and how to deal with data.
Right.
You know, that was built on the platform, but that only started a year ago when things were far more stable.
Yeah.
So I think that's a much better example of how that team was super productive and not built on top of a changing platform. So I think we'll see the boats rise, maybe not quite as fast as we would like,
right.
but hopefully faster than they have been, and in a more controlled way.
Yeah. Cool.
And certainly as Windows becomes more componentized,
yes.
with the layering, you'll be able to plop in stuff much quicker without having to rebuild the whole system every time, right?
Yeah.
You'll be totally decoupled from the kernel and et cetera and other components. So that's going to be awesome for you guys as far as shipping out.
Layering will be really good for us. You know, the other thing that I'm super, super focused on going forward is adding value off-cycle. You know, if there's a way for us to ship a sample in, you know, 3 months after launch or even in November, we'll do it.
Right.
You know, we'll get it out there because we think we can add value and not wait for big releases.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of the philosophy we want to use is we'll ship stuff out of samples kind of off-band, and then on a yearly cycle, we'll kind of migrate those into the primary namespace and say now they're part of the platform. Or for things that didn't work so well, bye-bye, they're gone. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to use them anymore. But it kind of gives people an ability to see what we're doing, see where we're going, and rev much more quickly than they have today. I'm grateful for people sticking with us as long as they have, because it's taken us far too long, and we've got to do a way better job kind of being more responsive and helping them with their business realities they have.
Sure.
Excellent.
So in closing, I mean, what would you like people watching this video to take away? What would you like developers who visit places like Channel 9 to do with Avalon? What's your kind of your short-term call to action for them?
Well, you know, the thing that I'd love for people to do is to look at the platform and then think about the applications that they would have loved to build but they somehow couldn't have built before, and think about how the platform can help them really expand the state of the art in their areas. You know, if the platform frees up anybody to do something they couldn't have done before, then that's hugely successful. So, boy, like, think big, dream it, and build it. And then, you know, kind of selfishly, if there's stuff that we're doing that you love, please tell us to make sure we keep doing it. And if there are things we're doing that you don't like, I'd love to know, because we'd like to make it better. And if it just doesn't make sense, well, we would like to know that too. So try it out, dream big, and tell us what works and tell us what doesn't work. That's the best possible thing I could ask for.
Cool. Michael, it's been super interesting talking to you. Thank you for your time.
Well, thanks a lot.
Cheers.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks.